First of all, thanks so much to Aaron and to Eduardo for the invitation to be here. It really is a great pleasure to be in this wonderful space. The weather could have been better. I'm not sure I've missed Cape Town as much as on the about 10-minute walk from my hotel to here, with the wind sort of in my face. Therefore, thank you very much for being here in these circumstances. As you would have gathered from the film, I came to the subject matter not with intention. I had belonged to the ANC, the African National Congress, since my late teens in South Africa, and I had to leave the country in the mid-1980s. Went back as soon as the ANC was unbanned in the early 90s and worked first as a facilitator in the constitutional negotiations that led to our first democratic elections in 94. And in those elections, became an ANC member of parliament. One of my roles was as the ranking ANC member of the main financial oversight committee in parliament. And we received a report about this arms deal that our own government had done. As Mandela was stepping down from office, his successor, Thabo Mbeki, decided to spend $10 billion on weapons that we had absolutely no need of. And the only reason we did that arms deal was because $300 to $400 million of bribes were paid to some of the ministers who made the decisions about what to buy and who to buy it from. Many of the officials, including the head of the military in the country, and a number of executives of the state-owned arms company. And my committee tried to investigate that deal, and I was warned by my own party to stop the investigation, primarily because the ANC itself had used some of those bribes to fund our second election campaign in 1999. And eventually I was called in by the presidency and given the choice of trying to continue the investigation and being thrown out of parliament, which in our constitutional system, each political party that elects you on a party list can remove you during the parliamentary year on a particular date and just put the next person in the list in. So you're entirely dependent for your political career on your party leadership. So they gave me the choice of trying to continue the investigation and getting thrown out, or stopping the investigation and having a glittering political career, as it was put to me. Why did I decide to still try and investigate this matter, knowing that it would end my political career? The effects of this arms deal on the country and on our very young democracy, which had been born with such hope in 1994. You know, for the first 4 years, when Mandela was in charge of both the party and the government, it really felt like we could build something different and exceptional in South Africa, something where the national interest was paramount, where party interest or personal political interest or material accumulation was secondary to building a united, non-racial, non-sexist nation. And to put it very crudely, that arms deal fucked that up. And it's not like it suddenly happened. It was coincidence that it was an arms deal. In the negotiations process that had gone on from 1991, during the lunch breaks, during the dinner breaks, amidst all the politicians, there were these besuited gentlemen who I only discovered years later were executives from the world's arms companies. And what they were telling the person they knew would be our first democratic minister of defense, Thabo Mbeki, who they knew would effectively be Mandela's prime minister and run government, was that an arms deal was not only a great idea to keep the white generals on side, who were not thrilled with this notion of a left-wing liberation movement coming to office, but that it was also a great way to fund your political party and a great way to effectively oil your corruption network, your patronage network within the party. And to understand that dimension, the way in which these arms deals are sold to politicians, is crucial to understanding the nature and the impact of this trade on our world. The consequences were that a modus operandi was established with this deal and its hundreds of millions of dollars of corruption that have been used ever since to steal from the public purse in South Africa. Thabo Mbeki's successor as president was a man called Jacob Zuma, who faced 783 counts of fraud, corruption, and racketeering in relation to that arms deal. The charges were dropped a few weeks before he was elected president, and the prosecutor who dropped them was made a judge a few weeks after the election. Jacob Zuma's 8 years in office saw him and his family, his father to at least 24 children that we know of, steal tens of billions of dollars from the South African people in a process that has been described as state capture. But on a more positive note, having been removed from power by the ANC, Jacob Zuma will go on trial in April of this year. And I'm even willing to wear a suit and tie when I give evidence against him, which is not something I do with any great desire. But there was another dimension to it that is a very important dimension of this trade, and that is the socioeconomic opportunity cost. So let's just cast our mind back to this country facing no enemies, facing no military threat whatsoever, and the socioeconomic challenges it faced as we became a democracy for the first time. A shortfall of 2.5 million houses, 2 million of which could have been built by the money used on this arms deal. The need to make up for over 300 years of racist, unequal, oppressive education. We could have built, quite literally, hundreds of new schools and paid all of the teachers required by those schools for the following 10 years with the money spent on this arms deal. A country that then and today has a formal unemployment rate of almost 30%. We could have created over 100,000 jobs per year over the following 10 years with the money used to pay for these weapons. But perhaps most tragic of all is that at the time that Thabo Mbeki announced this arms deal was the same time that he announced to the almost 6 million South Africans living with HIV or AIDS that we did not have the fiscal resources to provide the antiretroviral medication that they needed to stay alive. Over the following 5 years, according to a study undertaken at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, very conservatively put, 365,000 South Africans died avoidable deaths as a consequence of that policy choice. 35,000 babies every year during those 5 years were born HIV positive because we could not afford mother-to-child transmission treatment because we'd spent all the money on weapons that we've never used. That was my introduction to the trade in weapons. And my assumption was that we in South Africa were particularly naive, were particularly gullible. We created a government of people like myself, who had become activists and anti-apartheid campaigners, not thinking we could actually see the endpoint of the system of apartheid, never imagining that one day we might be in government, and really quite ill-equipped to form a government. But as I started researching my first book, a book called After the Party, which I wrote after I'd been forced out of Parliament, what became apparent to me was that what had happened in South Africa was happening all over the world, all the time. And that's what led me to my second book, which is what the film was based on, which is this, The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. When the first hardback edition of this book came out, published by Strauss Faro Giroux in the US, people suggested that it looked a bit like a weapon of mass destruction itself, particularly if thrown at anyone. And so the American publishers, this is the British paperback edition, used the thinnest paper possible. And the almost 3,000 footnotes are unreadable without a magnifying glass. The reason there are almost 3,000 footnotes is because before this book came out, at the end of 2011 in its first edition, there hadn't been a book written about the global arms trade since 1979. For two primary reasons. The information is incredibly difficult to access. Why? National security imposed secrecy. And the participants in this trade, the politicians, the corporate executives, the intermediaries, the agents, dealers, brokers, are incredibly litigious people. So I was aware of at least three books just in the UK where publishers had agreed to publish books written on the subject, had received the manuscripts, and their lawyers decided not to publish. I was very fortunate in that what I'd done before I got kicked out of Parliament was, while Thabo Mbeki as president was on a foreign visit, I got the cabinet secretary to ensure that I received every single document on this deal. I knew that the day Mbeki landed back in the country and found out that we'd got access to these documents, he would demand that they be returned. But of course, that gave us the time to copy them. So I had access to minutes of meetings, formal and informal, to the goings-on between the companies, the politicians, the companies, the officials, the politicians, the companies, and the intermediaries. In many instances in which they spoke quite openly about the bribes. And for prosecutors around the world, that was a treasure trove. So when I left South Africa to write my first book, which I thought I'd do better in the UK than in South Africa, where I'd had to be placed under protective surveillance, I suddenly found I was getting approached by people from all over the world, including prosecutors. And they said, "Won't you come and help us? We're working on the same company that you have covered, but you have insight to documentary evidence that we don't know about. So I started working with these various prosecutors around the world, and where it was legally possible, access documents from them about other transactions. And that's the basis on which this book was written. But it's incredibly important to bear that in mind, the secretive nature of this trade and the difficulty of accessing information on it for reasons that will become apparent. I suppose the other reason that the first book led to the second was I felt great anger towards people like Jacob Zuma and Thabo Mbeki. Zuma, who had been personally corrupted, and Mbeki, who was very willing to take bribes, not for himself personally, but for the party. But I realized that, for instance, the British company BAE Systems, which you come across a lot in the film, while paying £115 million of bribes to win just one contract in South Africa, for which they hadn't even made the shortlist, because they didn't meet a whole lot of the technical specifications, they were paying similar bribes on similar deals in seven other countries at the same time. But it's South Africa. It's India. It's Angola, Nigeria, that we in the global north see as corrupt. But who the fuck is doing the corrupting? It's us. And it's not morons like Ricardo Privatira, the arms dealer who you see in the film, the guy with the extensive belly, who at one point while we were interviewing him, Johan, the director, adored him. We did three interviews with him. In the third of them, he was sitting on a very low chair in his office, and his belly, which at the time was vast, was literally millimeters from the floor. And I'm sort of standing there as Johan's asking him questions and he's responding, and Johan says to him at one point, "So have you ever feared for your life?" And Privatira is sitting there and he's saying, "Ach, Johan, if you only knew the number of people who try to kill me. It's why I keep myself in such good shape." And I'm sort of standing there thinking, when did you last look in a mirror? But these aren't the world's main arms dealers. The world's main arms dealers are the occupants of the White House, Number 10 Downing Street, the Chancellery in Berlin, the Élysée Palace in Paris. Our political leaders buy and sell more weapons than all of the Ricardo Privateras of this world. And these leaders, together with the executives, the highly paid, incredibly well-dressed, tiny elite who run the Lockheed Martins and Northrop Grumman's and BAE Systems of this world, they are the corruptors. But when Transparency International produces, as it just has this year, its annual Corruption Perceptions Index, the countries of the global north sit at its apex. But all of the bribes are coming from these countries in ways that were illustrated in the film. This trade accounts for almost 40% of all corruption in all global trade. 40%. But the crucial dimension of that corruption is exactly these relationships between our governments in their broadest sense, because it's not just the Pentagon, the military. It's the intelligence agencies, often the State Department, the Treasury. So the state in its broadest sense. Individual politicians, undoubtedly. The executives and the intermediaries. It is the most extreme manifestation of the way in which business and politics are intertwined. a process that I believe, since the advent of neoliberalism in the late 1970s, has corrupted both business and politics. I'm not saying they were entirely clean before then, but this was the point at which they became systemically corrupted like they hadn't been before. The United States of America plays an extraordinarily dominant role in this trade. 40% of all weapons made in the world are made here. 40% of all weapons bought and sold in the world are bought and sold by the United States of America. The United States is involved in more conflicts and has been since the Second World War than any other country on the planet. The United States reflects what has been described as a militarist mindset in a way that surpasses even military dictatorships. Militarism has become so imbued in American life, in American politics, and in American culture to what I describe as terrifying degrees in the book. And the predominant consequence of that is that this country sees the solution to almost every conflict, almost every disagreement, as a military solution rather than a diplomatic one. We have some figures in the book and some graphs that show, since the late 1970s, the changes in allocations of money to the Pentagon and to the State Department, and they go like that. But more than any graphs, what reflects this point to me is the fact that, as Robert Gates, the former defense secretary, said, the government of the United States of America employs more people to run one aircraft carrier than it has diplomats across the entire world. Today, the United States of America has 11 aircraft carriers. What is unique about the United States defense system is not only how all-powerful it is, how all-dominant it is culturally, but also the fact that domestic procurement, procurement for the American military, is a system of what I describe as legalized bribery. I've never seen anything like it anywhere else in the world, in any system of public procurement, where politicians take money from companies, quite legally, for their campaigns, sit on relevant committees to ensure that they return multi-billion dollar projects to those very same companies. Now, if one did that openly anywhere in Europe or the United Kingdom, or even in South Africa or Bangladesh, it would be illegal bribery. In this country, it's legal and accepted. Something that I actually find absolutely terrifying. And what that system does, as the film tries to illustrate, is ensure this constant turning of the circle of money between companies, the military, politicians, and the intermediaries, lobbyists, dealers, etc. What we describe as the national security elite. And in fact, the way in which this whole system is presented to you, the citizens of the United States of America, is as a remarkably patriotic endeavor, an endeavor that is securing the United States for you. We did a book in 2017 called Indefensible, Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade. When I say we, this is myself and my very tiny research team at my organization, Corruption Watch in London. We came across figures that we at first didn't believe, so we had to verify. And that is that I think it was 47 or 48% of Americans believe that either they or a member of their direct family will die in a terrorist attack in the next 12 months. Americans are more likely to be killed by a toddler under the age of 4 in their own homes with their own weapon than they are to die in a terrorist attack of any sort. And I would include in that white supremacist right-wing terrorism, which is far more a feature of American life than so-called Islamist terrorism. And I must tell you that I use all of this nomenclature with a great deal of caution. I worked for a man who was described by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher as a terrorist, and who, in the early 1980s, they tried to persuade the South African government to execute, because they thought, even with a life sentence in prison, he was a danger to the neoliberal world order. That, of course, was Nelson Mandela. Hence my caution in the use of this nomenclature. But the reality is, despite this extraordinary fear industry, of which Hollywood is an absolutely crucial dimension, what some people describe as the military-industrial entertainment complex, the most extraordinary thing is that what this national security paradigm does in the United States of America is, first of all, suck an enormous amount of money out of public services, out of public goods, and out of the economy. Oh no, that can't be right. This is a great job creator. It's a great engine of economic growth. Now, I belong to a generation of white male South Africans who spent far too long in universities, because it was the only way to avoid serving in the apartheid army. So I have a number of degrees, ranging from clinical psychology to a whole lot in economics. And what astonishes me is how these assumptions of the economic benefits of this industry are simply not questioned. Because if you actually look at the research, first of all, these industries receive more public investment, public money, public subsidy than any other industry in economic history. Second of all, as a job creator, they are appalling. For the amount of public investment in every defense sector job, you could create between 3 and 7 additional jobs in other, more socially, and as importantly, more economically productive sectors. In fact, in most countries, the defense sector acts as a drain on economic growth. The only exception is the United States. But the defense sector is not a contributor to growth. It has a neutral economic impact on growth in the United States of America. Which is why the massive public subsidization has to be justified by the creation of the fear. But there's something even more fundamental than that. We are told constantly, through the militarization of everyday life, that what this national security elite is doing is making us safer. Well, actually, it's not. Let me explain how. Prince Bandar bin Sultan, who you met in the film, who received just over £1 billion, not dollars, pounds, in bribes on the Al-Yamamah deal. The money was paid into his account in Riggs Bank in Washington, D.C., which used to be diagonally opposite the White House and where all American presidents have banked. Inadvertently, according to Mr. Bandar, some of that money found its way into his wife's account and into the accounts of two of the 9/11 hijackers. After the tragedy of 9/11, three planes were allowed into American airspace. One had on board President George W. Bush, because for a period of time, it was felt that the place in which he was safest was in the air while they tried to figure out what was actually going on. But there were two other planes that were allowed to take off and fly through American airspace. And they transported various Saudi citizens back to Saudi Arabia, including dozens of members of the Bin Laden family. Because the Bin Laden family is a pillar of Saudi society, where they have constructed most of the public infrastructure and palaces for the ruling royal family. Now, Saudi Arabia is probably the West's biggest political and military ally. They are certainly the recipients of more weaponry than any other country besides the United States on the planet. There's a little complication in that. The Saudi royal family promote a form of Islam called Wahhabism, which is the most extreme, intolerant, and violent form of Islam. And they spend billions of dollars promoting Wahhabism around the world, and it is used to recruit vast numbers of young people who our media would describe to us as Islamists. In addition to which, Saudi Arabia is probably the biggest financier and weaponizer of groups who we have been fighting the war on terror in its various forms against since 9/11. So the whole basis of the way in which we distribute weaponry and the way in which we conceive of our national security has as its core an absurdity where our greatest ally is also the greatest sponsor of our supposed greatest enemy. So how in hell's name does this make us safer? Well, let's take the cases of Syria and Yemen at the moment. In Syria, we, and when I say we, I mean Western governments led by the United States of America, together with our allies, the Saudis and the Emiratis, have been financing and providing weapons to a whole range of militia groups because they're opposed to the Al-Assad regime, which has for many years been a dictatorial and pretty brutal regime. But these groups are predominantly offshoots of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And in fact, most absurdly, some of these groups are fighting against the very same coalition Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis in Yemen. And we wonder how weapons that we're giving to groups in Syria, because we're on the same side as them, are finding their way to groups we're fighting against in Yemen. And the root of those weapons is very simple. They're often the same organization. So we're actually, through key dimensions of our national security policy and practice, ensuring continuing conflicts, particularly in the Middle East, but in many other parts of the world. But there are other ways in which the trade makes us less safe. And that is because these companies, the Lockheed Martins, Northrop Grumman's, Boeing's of the world, are not spending their time liaising with the Pentagon, and it's worth mentioning here, that on average, every year, around 84% of retiring generals at the Pentagon go into very senior, very well-paid executive positions with the exact defense contractors they've been giving contracts to their entire military careers. And between the Pentagon and these contractors, they decide what weaponry the United States government needs to protect itself and its people. The problem is, after 9/11, they took exactly the weapon systems that they were already building and simply changed the PR around them and made them crucial for the newly minted war on terror. So what was the practical manifestation of this? Well, let me give you just one quick example. A huge homeland security weakness was identified after 9/11 as the Coast Guard. So a contract for almost $11 billion was given to one of the big three to build literal combat vessels to reinforce the Coast Guard. Over a 10-year period, they managed to produce one weapon. And when it was launched into water, the hull cracked. So on review of that contract, the company was given additional money to continue with the contract. Only one change was made. Rather than provide oversight of the contract themselves, oversight of the contract was undertaken by another defense contractor. While you were watching the film, I was catching up on some information, discovered that the most expensive military vessel ever produced in the United States of America, the Gerald Ford, has faced 20 major operational failures since it was launched in late 2017. Does it make any difference? Absolutely not. So this industry is making us safer. What this industry is the master of Orwellian doublespeak. I was going to talk a little bit about the conflict in Yemen, where 15,000 civilians have died, not as collateral damage, but the vast majority of them have been consciously targeted by the Saudi and Emirati coalition. Places of residence, places of worship, hospitals, schools, economic infrastructure have all been targeted. That is all being done with American, British, and European weapons. The Americans and the British are actually advising the coalition on targeting. 85,000 children have starved to death in Yemen since the conflict started in March of 2015. The United States suspended for a few weeks under the Obama administration its sales to Saudi Arabia. never suspended its sales to the United Arab Emirates, and that suspension was obviously lifted as soon as the Trump administration came to power. The British government has sold the Saudis almost £5 billion worth of weaponry since that conflict has started. Why? Yemen is part of an endgame, and the endgame is regime change in Iran. And we saw in the film for how many decades that has been the objective of the so-called neoconservatives. Finally, let me talk for a couple of minutes about the process of taking a book with almost 3,000 footnotes and trying to turn it into a film. When the book first came out in late 2011, I received a number of offers from producers around the world to make a film about it, a drama series, a fictional film. And then I was approached by Jocelyn Barnes and Danny Glover, who, as you heard at the beginning, run Louverture Films. What was different about that conversation was that they got what I was trying to do in the book, to show the systemic nature of the trade. And they loved the idea of making a feature documentary about it. So we started speaking to directors, and we had spoken to 18 directors, all of whom had the brilliant idea of telling the story through my personal story. So this poor white South African who'd had to give up his political career, like there's a political career that hasn't ended in failure, to be able to investigate and explore this awful industry. For all sorts of very obvious reasons, that approach didn't appeal to me. Fortunately, it didn't appeal to Joss or Danny either. And then we met Johan Grimonprez, who is a Belgian visual artist and who's only made two other films, brilliant films, if you haven't seen them. One called Dial History, about media perceptions of hijacking. The other, a film called Double Take, which looks at the nuclear arms race and particularly the relationship between Nixon and Khrushchev, but does so through the lens of Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. It is not a conventional documentary. And I went to see, on Joss's instructions, I went to see Johan in Brussels. We had dinner together. The book looked like a mini Amazon forest. There were things sticking out of it everywhere. It had changed color. And Johan slapped it down on the table where we were having dinner. And he said to me, "I'm really not interested in your story." He said, "We've got to figure out how in 90 minutes we can convey the systemic nature of this trade and the fact that it has this continuity, this power of reproduction, that regardless of what age and era we're living in, it remains a central part of our politics." I immediately decided that I wanted to go with Johan. Joss was very excited about the idea because she had decided years before, when she'd seen Dial History, she was going to make a film of it. Danny thought we were insane. And there began a process that lasted almost 5 years. And just imagine this. You have a highly intellectual European film director whose entire body of work, both artistic and filmic, has focused on the difficulty of attributing meaning to anything. The slipperiness of fact and meaning. And next to him, you have an investigative researcher and writer who takes 7.5 years to write a book with 3,000 footnotes, and who knows that if he gets one fact wrong in the book, he's going to be sued, and because he has no money, will land up in jail given UK libel and defamation law. This is not a combination made in heaven. But I think, and I can obviously only speak for myself, and the fact that Johan and I are still very good friends hopefully attests to the fact that it was an extraordinary process for both of us, because we had to enter each other's worlds, and we had to start seeing these issues from each other's perspective. The difficulties of this approach really came home to us when we had to take a 4.5 hour rough cut and turn it into a final 90-minute film, which I have to say, outside of my activist and political life, was the most difficult thing I've ever had to do. We did an extraordinary interview with Noam Chomsky. Never made it into the final 90 minutes. The first 9/11. Never made it into the final 90 minutes. An interview with Andrew Bacevich, an absolutely incredible academic at BU, a former colonel in the Marine Force, who 3 months before we interviewed him, his son had been killed in Iraq. One of the most eloquent critics of US militarism, despite being a conservative Catholic Republican. Never made it into the final 90 minutes. Johan and I, who are not the two most aggressive macho men you're going to come across, came to points over that final 3 months where we could very happily have thrown each other out of a 10th floor window. But it was an extraordinary learning experience for both of us, in that he came to realize what was fundamental to the integrity of the research. And I came to realize how incredibly deep-seated the manufacture of meaning in the arms trade and the militarism it creates has become, and how incredibly difficult it is and complex it is to unpack that. So how do we stop wars? The only way we're going to stop wars is to stop the arms trade, is to stop the money-making that underpins these wars, because too many people are making too much money out of these wars, and that's the bottom line. And what neoliberalism says to us is the entire world, and in fact, beyond our planet, is a marketplace that we can monetize and that we must monetize. The most effective way the United States of America has found to do that is through war. And it's why the United States has become so brutal, both in its foreign policy, but also in its domestic policies. If we look at the militarization of policing in this country, if we look at what led to the Black Lives Matter movement, the dehumanizing of entire groups of people that has obviously been accentuated by the current administration to unimaginable degrees, is the United States of America's war on itself, because that too is monetized. What we've managed to do with the film, and I was complaining to Joss about this just the other day, I was saying to her, you know, I travel between 200 and 250 days a year because I continue to show the film all over the world. In the United Kingdom, over the last 15 months, we've created almost 30 groups working on the arms trade locally around the United Kingdom. There was never such group in the country's second biggest city, Birmingham. But after screenings in a church and a mosque, people in those two audiences came together to create such a group. In a village in Wales, where they claim they have a population of more than the 47 people who are in the screening, I remain unconvinced. They now have a group looking at the links between their local council, which has a budget that is a fraction of the budget of the film, to the British arms trade. So the film has been an incredibly powerful tool in the work that we do. There is hope. The fact that wherever we take the film, in the United Kingdom at the moment, the screenings are packed out, be it at universities, be it at churches, at mosques, at community halls, community centers. And the United Kingdom is in some ways a mini-me of the United States of America on a lot of these issues. And it just reminds me of what the anthropologist Margaret Mead said towards the end of her quite remarkable and not unproblematic life. History is changed by the actions of small groups of thoughtful, committed citizens working together. It has always been the case, and it always will be. This is a very powerful edifice that we've been talking about tonight. But everything has its tipping point, and the tipping point of this will come. Go onto a website called projectindefensible.org. Our latest book, The Seven Myths That Sustain the Global Arms Trade, are on there. Have a read of it for free. Show it to other people. Do your little bit. And it might not be in your lifetime or in my lifetime, but that's not what's important. But one day, the majority of people in this country, which despite its president is a great country, will realize that the militarism that underpins it is not in its own interests. And to that end, I'm incredibly grateful to Johan for putting up with me and the nature of our work, because if I had made this film, it would be a 555-page book with 3,000 footnotes. And it's why I'm so grateful to Aaron and Eduardo for inviting us to show the film here. And I do hope that you found it worthwhile as well.